Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, today's a really great day. I have two nonfiction books that are so well written, so brilliant, that they read like fiction. And I actually was reading them and I forgot that I'm reading a nonfiction book. So it's really exciting. At the bottom of the hour, I have Denise Kiernan, who wrote an absolutely wonderful book called The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty. And it is about the Vanderbilts and the wonderful, wonderful residence that they built in North Carolina. So I'm excited to talk to her about that book. But right now I'm going to talk about one of my really very, very favorite subjects, because I love dinosaurs. I've always loved dinosaurs and dreamt about actually going out and digging for some. So I'm really eager to talk about a book called The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaur, A New History of a Lost World. And the author is Steve Brusatte. Is he on? Okay.
Steve Brusatte, whose new book, The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs, A New History of a Lost World, is just fantastic. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Okay, great. Well, this is amazing. This book is wonderful. You know, it's nonfiction, but it reads like a novel. I'm reading, I'm turning the pages. It's so exciting. And I was thinking this morning, you know, I broadcast here out of Clearwater, Florida. And so there I am sitting this morning watching dinosaurs fly past my window. And it was really exciting because of your book. I know every time I see a seagull flying, and I get a lot of them, there I am thinking about you.
Yep, I see the same. We have seagulls all over here in Edinburgh and Scotland, where I live now and where I teach. And it's just mind-boggling when you look at birds today, just to think that they came from the dinosaurs, that they are modern-day dinosaurs. They are part of that great evolutionary story of dinosaurs. And, you know, a very important part of the rise and fall of the dinosaurs, and I'm glad you enjoy the book. I think that's really cool that you kind of think that it reads like a novel, and I'm glad to hear that, because it is a story I've tried to tell, this history of dinosaurs, where they came from and how they rose up and how they went extinct. And it's an incredible storyline. It really is. I think it's one of the greatest stories in the history of our planet, so hopefully I've been able to do it justice.
Well, you definitely do, and it's so funny because I every morning I'm sitting there watching around my third cup of coffee, because I start drinking early in the morning, but when the seagulls start coming out, and I always think of Jonathan Livingston Seagull, but now I'm going to have to think of Jonathan Livingston Dinosaur.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing that, to me, which is with seagulls, you know, I think they're the same everywhere around the world, but certainly here, you know, they're notorious for attacking people on the beach. They dive bomb down. They try to take people's French fries and ice cream and all of this. And I think when a seagull does that, you can see the cunning. You can see the violence. You know, you can see the inner velociraptor in a seagull. And I just think that's so cool to feel that connection with the world of ancient prehistory like that.
Well, actually, I have been terrified by, you know, I know better than to go out there and start throwing bread around like some people do. And they come in this massive quantities of birds that they just, it's terrifying. So I'm now thinking, wow, if those were a little bit bigger.
Yes, they were. And the dinosaurs, what is so thrilling about the dinosaurs is they were around for such a long time. They were an empire, and they dominated the Earth for over 150 million years. And yes, they do live on today as birds, which is amazing. But in the past, long before there were humans, you had T-Rexes, and you had Brontosauruses, and you had Triceratops. You had all of these fantastic creatures living all over the world, every continent, every conceivable environment. The dinosaurs were on top of nature. They were the dominant animals before us, and really we now wear the crown that the dinosaurs once wore, and hopefully we can learn a bit from the dinosaurs to the point where we don't go the way of the dinosaurs.
Exactly. And as I said, this book is, it is really so good. I always love to learn. And so when you have a book like this, and then you also are just so entertained with all your little anecdotes and stories about your travels. I mean, like, do you have, like, the best job in the world? I mean, everybody wants your job. You have just carved a niche for yourself. I mean, you are such an authority now on dinosaurs. Everybody turns to you, BBC and everybody else, because you know all about them. And you write so very compellingly that it makes people want to know more.
I do think I have the best job in the world. You know, it's humbling, really, to think about how fortunate you can be to spend your life traveling around, digging up dinosaurs, studying new species, finding and studying these fossils that have never been seen by humans before, that tell stories of vanished worlds from millions, hundreds of millions of years ago, and to get to work with so many people. And one of the things I try to do in the book is tell a lot of the stories of, myself traveling around digging up dinosaurs, but also the stories of some of my colleagues, some of these other paleontologists all over the place, this very diverse lot of people, men and women, and especially younger people, and especially in developing countries like China and Brazil and Argentina. These are the people making the discoveries, and a lot of them are real characters. A lot of them seem like characters from a novel, but these are the men and women that are finding dinosaurs these days, and I'm very fortunate to be part of a field like this. It is endlessly fascinating.
Well, you know, my grandparents came from the old country, and they got the 40 acres and a mule kind of thing. So my family owns 80 acres of land in northern Michigan, and I've always wanted to find out, do you think we have any dinosaurs up there? Because I've always thought about, well, when I'm ready to retire, I'm going to go back up to the farm, and I'm going to get myself, I'm going to start just digging like crazy until I find some dinosaurs.
That's funny. You know, I'm from Illinois originally. I'm from near Chicago. And it seems to be the opposite, really, is people from Michigan, they usually move to Florida, not the other way around, right? Which part of Michigan is it that you're...
I'm a Youper from right up there in near Berga and Hancock. We have a lot of copper mines. Now they're all empty, but we had a lot of copper mines. And I've always wondered if there's any chance that we would have dinosaurs there. I would, you know, start I used to dig with a spoon, but you know, maybe I'd get a little, you know, when I was a kid. Because I would either find gold or I'd find dinosaurs.
Yeah, I must confess I don't know a whole lot about the Upper Peninsula. I have some cousins that are from there, but I've never actually been to the Upper Peninsula myself. But what I do know about it is that the rocks there are really old. They're some of the oldest rocks in all of North America. These are rocks that are billions of years old. So these rocks are from a long time before the dinosaurs, and there are fossils there. But I don't think there are any dinosaurs. So if you do find some, they'd probably be the first. But the upside of that, though, is that the rocks that are there are so old that they put the dinosaurs to shame. The dinosaurs merely lived, you know, 100-some million years ago. Some of these rocks in the Upper Peninsula are a few billion years old. And if you really want to feel the depths of time, look at a rock, stand on a rock that is billions of years old, and just think about everything that that rock has experienced. And that, you know, I think these deep timelines are kind of hard to understand anyway, because they're so out of scale with, you know, human experience. But the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. It's incredibly old, and it's a fragile place, but also a robust place, and there have been times of great environmental and climactic upheaval. There have been changes in temperature and rises and falls in sea level, and the continents have come together and broken apart, and big volcanoes have erupted, and asteroids have hit, and it's animals like dinosaurs that actually had to put up with these changes.
So
that's why dinosaurs and other fossils are relevant.
What's the oldest dinosaur we know? When did they start and when did they end?
Yeah, the origin story of dinosaurs to me is really fascinating, because all great empires have to start somehow. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day, right? That's what the cliche says, and it's the same with dinosaurs. They didn't sweep across the world the moment they originated. In fact, they were very humble for the early part of their history. Really, the first 50 million years of their history, dinosaurs were living in the shadows. They were small animals. The first ones were just about the size of a house cat. They were awkward, gangly-looking animals. They ran around on all fours on these stilty arms and legs, and they were living right after a horrible extinction that killed off almost all living things. There were these big volcanoes that erupted, and that almost cleared the world, but it cleared the deck as well. So it gave new groups of animals a chance to rise up. And dinosaurs were one of those groups, but so were crocodiles, and so were turtles, and so were mammals. And it was some of these other animals that were eclipsing dinosaurs for a long time. And it was only after another extinction, when there were some more volcanoes that wiped out a bunch of the crocodiles, that dinosaurs wrestled control. And that's when dinosaurs became dominant. That's when they spread around the world. That's when they grew to huge sizes. That's when they started to develop feathers and wings. And so it's an origin story that took a long time. It took dinosaurs quite a while to become the most successful animals that ever lived. And these first, very oldest, most humble little dinosaur precursors lived about 250 million years ago, a long, long, long time ago. And it was only about 200 million years ago that dinosaurs started to spread around the world and properly become the dominant Brontosaurus, T-Rex, Triceratops types of animals that we all know and love.
So literally most of the Earth was covered with dinosaurs? I mean, there were dinosaurs everywhere?
That's right. Dinosaurs look like they lived pretty much everywhere, at least after they eventually spread around the world. At the beginning of their time, they only lived in certain places. They only lived in the more humid and cooler places. They couldn't really live in the warmer places, the deserts. But later on, they spread everywhere, and they lived on every continent. And we find their fossils today almost everywhere where there are rocks of the right age and the right type. So there are dinosaur fossils from Antarctica. There are dinosaur fossils from above the Arctic Circle in Alaska. There are dinosaurs from Australia, from New Zealand, from across North America and Europe and Africa, South America. They're everywhere. They were utterly dominant. They were the premier animals for over 150 million years.
Well, it's sometimes hard to contemplate. That's why I love dinosaur movies. I've always loved dinosaur movies because, as I said, because I was very one of those dreamy kind of kids, you know, reading books and dreaming about adventures all the time. And of course, between looking for gold and I was looking for dinosaurs. I think it's just so cool that you have this wonderful job. And now, of course, you're in Scotland. I think that is like the perfect place for a paleontologist. I know the university there, and it's just, I just love to think of you there. They have to really make you into a movie, I think, because they really do. You are absolutely fantastic, and your stories, the way you are able to, as you said, tell about other paleontologists and share in their excitement, because you guys are always so excited. I think that's one of the wonderful things about paleontology. You always find something new. And you don't mind if somebody else finds something, because then you can rush off and visit them.
Yeah, I think you'd have to really work hard to be a cynic in this line of work. When you get to travel around the world, digging up dinosaurs, discovering new fossils that no humans have ever seen before, that are our only evidence for these amazing beasts that lived hundreds of millions of years ago. If you can't get excited about that, then I think, well, you're probably not going to get excited about much. And for me, it's a really cool thing to be living and working here in Scotland. It's not a place I ever thought I would live when I was growing up in Illinois and in the middle of northern Illinois, in the middle of the cornfields and bean fields there. But this career studying dinosaurs has brought me out here to this beautiful city, the Scottish capital, one of the grand old cities of Europe, and an epicenter for geology and for paleontology for many centuries now. And fossils very plentiful in Scotland, but we're starting to find a lot of new dinosaurs here, especially on the Isle of Skye, this gorgeous island off the west coast in the Atlantic, icy cold, rainy, windy, but just enchanting Tolkien-esque landscapes there, and we find dinosaur bones and dinosaur footprints on this island. We're going up again next month, and we're so excited just thinking about what we might find.
About everybody always asks, were dinosaurs really colorful? So what have you discovered?
When I was in school, and it wasn't that long ago, I'm in my mid-30s now, so when I was in school in the late 80s and throughout the 90s, all of the textbooks we had and all the books in the school library showed dinosaurs as drab, gray, green, brown brutes, these dumb animals plodding around, lingering around, just waiting to go extinct, failures. But that's not what dinosaurs were like. We now know that dinosaurs were totally successful, the biggest success stories in the history of Earth, I would say. And they were hyper-diverse, and they lived all around the world, and they could move fast, and they had big brains and keen senses. And we also know that they were often flamboyantly colored, and it is amazing. But some paleontologists have figured out a way to tell the colors of ancient dinosaurs, and you can do it if you have really well-preserved feathers or skin. And you can look under a really high-powered microscope, and you can see the individual pigment cells in there, and that can tell you what colors these dinosaurs were. And some of them were green and brown, but some were iridescent. They had those black, shiny feathers like crows do today. Some of them were ginger. Some of them even have had ringed tails like raccoons. So dinosaurs had all kinds of different colors. They were probably very similar to birds today. Look at all the colors that birds have. And to me, and I tell the story in the book, I just find it amazing that paleontologists, and it was a young guy, Jakob Winther's his name, who's more or less my age, he figured this out when he was a grad student. He figured out how to tell the color of dinosaurs. I am just find it incredible that somebody had the insight to do that, because we were always told that was impossible. And it's a real inspirational story. It tells us that we should never say anything's impossible in science.
Well, I want to tell you, as I said, I think this book is just so much fun to read. And I want everyone to get it. It's called The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs, A New History of a Lost World. It's just one of these books where you pick it up, you read it once, and then you want to go back. And also, there are like 70 illustrations in here. So it really is also, you know, from that point of view, it's very interesting. We get to see some photos of early paleontologists and of course, some of the bones and some of the places that, my goodness, you've been to so many wonderful places. It's just amazing.
It has been quite an adventure. And, you know, I've just been really fortunate to have great colleagues around the world. I know it sounds kind of trite to say that, but I've been really lucky. I've had great mentors at each stage of my career, and I get to work with some incredible people that are great fossil collectors, and hopefully I do justice to their stories in this book, because it is because of this new generation, this very diverse generation of young dinosaur hunters that we know so much these days. And we've learned so much over the last decade. If I tried to write this book a decade ago, I couldn't have done it. And that just makes me so excited about the next decade. Who knows what we're going to learn next about dinosaurs?
Exactly. And you're going to be right there, and you're going to come back and tell us about it, because I think you're also just a great writer and a fascinating person. And I love to think of you up there in Edinburgh and thinking about dinosaurs. I think it's fantastic.
Well, I'm so glad you liked the book, and I hope a lot of you that are listening are enthused by this conversation and go out and check out the book. Of course, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it in your local independent bookshops. Always good to support our local bookshops, and I just really hope that this book will help inspire a new generation of dinosaur hunters and also show kind of the older generation that we have learned so much new about dinosaurs than the stuff they were taught in school.
Okay, well, Steve Brusate, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It has been an absolute joy to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure's all mine.
Okay.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Okay. Oh, he's so nice. And the book is really lots of fun. Now, we have a moment, and so we're going to do one of Rita Moreau's book buzzes, because she always has some great cozy mystery for us to do. I don't know. Maybe you want to go to commercial first? Okay, book buzz. We have a book buzz.
Hello, Granny's Got a Gun, Secret Agent Granny Book Number 1 by Harper Lynn. Hey, this is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with Book Bunts. Fans of whodunits, here is the buzz for Granny's Got a Gun, a hilarious new mystery series from USA Today bestselling author Harper Lynn. Barbara Gold, a retired CIA agent, is bored out of her skull in Cheerville, a small town in New England, until a man is poisoned during a book club meeting for seniors. Everyone thinks Lucian had a heart attack, but from his symptoms, Barbara knows someone has slipped poison into his cake or drink. The clock ticks as she investigates who in Cheerville Active Readers Society would want Lucian dead. Suddenly, Barbara's CIA training is useful again, and Cheerville is starting to seem not so dull after all. Have fun reading the funny first novella, Granny's Got a Gun by Harper Lynn, in the Secret Agent Granny Mystery Series. Rita Moreau, reporting for Joy on Paper. For more on my suggestions on mysteries you should not miss, go to our webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and click on Book Buzz. That's radio-joyonpaper. This is Rita Moreau, buzzing off for now.
Okay, well, thank you, Rita. That was good. We're going to do a commercial break, and when we come back, I'm going to be talking to Denise Kiernan about The Last Castle.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I, or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back, and I am just waiting for Denise Kiernan to call in so that we can talk about her wonderful book called The Last Castle, which is the story about George Vanderbilt and the beautiful home that he built in North Carolina. So as I'm waiting for that call, I just want to remind you that Facebook is alive and well, and I need you to go to Facebook and like me. So it's Radio Joy on Paper. Go there, and it will be wonderful if you'll like me, and I will like you. And meanwhile, I have somebody that I really, really like, Denise Kiernan. Hi, Denise.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, great. Oh, I am so happy to talk to you. This book is so wonderful. It's called The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home. And it is just a wonderful book. I mentioned it at the beginning of the program. I said, It's a nonfiction book, but it's so beautifully written and it flows so nicely that I actually forgot I've been reading a nonfiction book. It's just...
Thank you. Nonfiction writers love to hear that, actually. Thank you so much.
You know, to the point that there's one section, I just have to say it, that it, when you're writing about Cornelia's wedding, it's like four or five pages. But it is so beautifully written that by the time I finished those pages, I had tears in my eyes. And I'm thinking, wow, this for, you know, as you said, for a nonfiction writer, when you get that emotion in a book, it is really remarkable.
Oh, thank you so much. I think it helps that I have a tremendous amount of passion for the subject matter. But I'm so glad you like that. I love that whole scene. It's I wanted readers to really feel like they were there at this spectacular, unbelievable wedding, and you know, be able to see in their mind's eye, you know, what her dress looked like, and what the festivities were like, and you know, all the emotion related to family members who were and were not there, you know. Spoiler alert.
and but, you accomplish that because, as I said, it is unusual when you are reading a nonfiction book that you become so deeply involved in it. And I did see it. I mean, I really felt like I was there, and it was it's a magnificent part of your book. But all of your book is great. But that particular part I love.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a fascinating time period to look at, not just the Gilded Age when the book starts, but also just moving into the Progressive Era and the Jazz Age when, you know, Cornelia got married, and sort of evoking all those super fabulous Great Gatsby kind of images. It was a lot of fun to write and research, a lot of fun.
Well, let's take a step back, because some people might not know too much about, they've heard about Vanderbilts, of course, everybody's heard about Vanderbilts, but
after but there are so many of them.
There's so many of them. And yeah. I was, of course, the most well-known one today is Anderson Cooper. And I was so taken when I looked at his photograph compared to the founder of the Klan, Cornelius, how very much alike they look.
Oh, my goodness. I have never done that.
Compare their photos.
Side-by-side comparison.
You have to do a side-by-side. It's uncanny. I mean,
oh my God.
They look exactly, he looks exactly like Cornelius did when Cornelius was young. So start with Cornelius, although the book starts with Edith, and who's a fascinating
Absolutely.
Character, but start with Cornelius.
I will. So Cornelius, a.k.a. the Commodore Vanderbilt, was the founder of the Vanderbilt family fortune. He's a guy who started off with next to nothing, and through some very shrewd business dealings and a lot of hard work, ended up with this massive shipping and railroad empire and became one of the richest men, you know, not just in the country, but in the world. So Cornelius left the bulk of his fortune to his son, William Henry Vanderbilt. William Henry took what he inherited, ran with it, and more than doubled it in no time flat. William Henry's youngest son was George Washington Vanderbilt, and he is one of the main characters in my book, The Last Castle, because he is the one who came down to North Carolina and fell in love with this area and decided to build his spectacular home, Biltmore House, here. So when you think about George being the youngest child of William Henry, this just immensely wealthy individual, you know, needless to say, George did not have to lift a finger to work. And he frankly spent his time doing what I would do if I didn't have to work. He went to theater. He went to concerts. He was a philanthropist. He read and read and read, and he traveled a lot. And in 1888, he traveled down to the Asheville, North Carolina region with his mother. And fell in love with the area.
Now, did you select today as a release date? Because today is the day, on May 1st, 1914, that Edith Vanderbilt donated Pisgah Forest to the nation.
You know, I actually have less say than you might imagine about when my books come out. But that is lovely to hear. Yes. But no, I can't. I wish I could choose when my hardcovers and my paperbacks come out. But alas, those decisions are made way above my head.
But what an appropriate day, because as I said, Edith is in many ways the star of this book, because
absolutely
what she did to preserve this home is unbelievable. So let's now go to the start of your book, where you do start with Edith, because as I said, she is pivotal. That it was fine that George had the idea, but boy, we needed
keeping
Edith.
It intact. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I have to say, Edith was one of the main driving inspirations for me to really dig into this story. I do start The Last Castle with Edith, and I did that for a number of reasons. First of all, I knew she was really going to be the star, one of the stars of the books, but really the star of the book in my eyes. Also, you know, I wanted to establish Edith as a young woman, as an independent woman, as an unmarried woman, before she, you know, becomes Mrs. George Vanderbilt or mistress of Biltmore House. I thought it was very, very important that Edith, you know, we get to know her as an individual before she becomes George's wife. And, you know, she had this incredible New York City lineage. She was a direct descendant of Peter Stuyvesant, who was the last Dutch governor of New York, before the colonies. And, you know, so she had this terrific old American heritage. And she and her sisters were just a really interesting pair. Her brother as well, but her sisters in particular, because, you know, there were the expectations of a young woman, you know, in the late 1800s were pretty much to, you know how to carry yourself, speak a little French, play a musical instrument, and get married. I mean, you know, that was throw a nice party. And she really, really, had this tremendous spunk about her. And her sisters did it as well. And I think some of that comes out of some early losses in their lives, some trials that they had to face as young women. I get into that early on in the book. And it really, I think, was formative for her. And she just, as she grows throughout the book, and she does become mistress of Biltmore House, what we see from her, I mean, and you jump in whenever you want, I could go on and on. I mean, what we see from her is just this incredible kindness of spirit, this wonderful philanthropic work, this real connection with members of the community, you know, people beyond the spectacular gates of Biltmore House, all of this wondrous stuff. And one of the things I really like about her was when she gave of herself to others, when she moved down to Western North Carolina and became mistress of Biltmore House, she wasn't the kind of person who merely just, you know, wrote some checks and sent them along their way to people who needed help. She was the kind of person who hopped on a horse and brought baskets of food and blankets to people who were in need, to employees who were ailing, or their spouses who were expecting. I mean, just amazing.
She is really quite amazing. And I think you did the right thing to start the book with her, because it is fantastic, the story of how George comes down there, and he comes to Pisgah Forest, and he looks out, and he gets this idea to build a house in really the middle of nowhere.
In the middle of nowhere, because at this point, right, end of the 19th century, you have these spectacular, what they used to call cottages, you know, in places like Newport, just these, you know, remarkable homes that people would build to stay at in the summertime. And a lot of people had, a lot of the wealthy on the East Coast, especially New York City, had homes in places like New York or Bar Harbor or the Berkshires. So for George, you know, to be so captivated by this region and then decide to build this estate, this retreat, in the wilds of Western North Carolina, so far away from where anybody else had done it, including his family members. It was really a really an original kind of take on his part, but he was really captivated by the area and captivated by the forest. Very, very captivated by the forest and dedicated himself to getting the forest back in shape.
Because he hired some of the most important people in our history.
Absolutely.
People who really, every time I think of New York City, and every time you see New York City, even, you know, they flash it in a television show, you see that wonderful, wonderful park. You see Central Park, and everybody, you know, and I always say to people, if you don't know, you know, a lot of names in history, you should know the name of Frederick Olmsted, because
Absolutely.
A gift, what a tremendous thing that we have. Can you imagine how ugly New York would be without that Central Park?
Oh my gosh. And when you think about, you know, these families who were building these country estates or summer retreats and hiring landscape, what we now refer to as landscape architects, Frederick Law Olmsted was the father of landscape architecture. I mean, he is the one who really made that field of study and practice what it is today. I think you'd be hard-pressed at any point in history to find a better person to be designing the grounds around your home. And he just, you know, what he did in Central Park, what he did, you know, in and around Massachusetts.
And Chicago. Well, I mean, Chicago, too.
Chicago, yes. And he, and, you know, speaking of Chicago, he and George Vanderbilt's architect, Richard Morris Hunt, were key figures in the 1893 Chicago World's Fair while they're trying to get Biltmore House wrapped up. I mean, these were the most sought after people of their time. And, you know, but George Vanderbilt, was working with them, you know, really at the height of their career. And it was the last, really the last great work for both men.
Well, give us, just so now for people who don't know about Biltmore.
Yes.
Wow. That was,
yes. You know, what's interesting to me is, you know, when I travel in and around, you know, North and South Carolina, perhaps Georgia, a lot, and sometimes Florida as well, you know, a lot of people know about Biltmore House. When I go out west or sometimes even up north or in the Midwest, you know, a lot of people don't know. It is the largest house ever in the United States of America at more than 175,000 square feet. I mean, that's not including conservatories and stables. I mean, that is the house. There was never a house bigger before then, and there never has been since.
Wow. I have not been able to go there yet, but definitely,
you gotta go.
I have to go. I've been to Newport and to see some of those houses, but they're like
those are tiny
compared to this house, which is. I 250 rooms. I think there were 33 bedrooms and 43 bathrooms and three kitchens and even two bowling alleys. So it's pretty magnificent.
And the indoor lighted swimming pool.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
I mean.
And the indoor lighted swimming pool, which, you know, you have to have in 1895. Absolutely.
So, wow, for you, you know, now, were you born in this area?
Oh, No. I'm an Army brat, and I first saw Biltmore when I was a teenager because my father was stationed in South Carolina, and one weekend I drove up with my mom, and I was a little history nerd already at 14. So unlike most teenagers, when their parent says, "Do you want to go see a historic house this weekend?" You know, most teenagers probably say, "Nah." I was like, "Yes, that'd be fun." So, I remember, and then I didn't go back to Biltmore House until 12 years ago. And, you know, between 14 and 12 years ago, I don't need to go into too much detail about how long that was, but it was a long time. And, you know, one of the things that struck me when I was a kid and that struck me again as an adult is you step through the doors of that home, and you really feel like you are stepping into a time capsule. You really, really, really do. So many of the family's original furnishings and tapestries and sculptures and art are in the house. You really feel like you are stepping back in time and visiting someone, you know, in the late 18, early 1900s. And there's still, you know, a good 8,000, I think 8,000 acres now still around the house. I'm not sure. And so the drive-in is still gorgeous and along the route that Frederick Law Olmsted imagined. And the trees are much more mature now, but behind the house, the same views that captivated George Vanderbilt, you know, more than 100 years ago, those same views are still there. So it really is like stepping back in time.
Well, that's one of the things that Olmsted wanted. He wanted that reveal. And I have a feeling that he could imagine what it would look like with the trees grown. You know, so.
Oh, yeah. And his vision was incredible, Frederick Law Olmsted. One of my favorite parts for sure was, you know, looking at his papers that are held at the Library of Congress. And he, like I said, he and Richard Morris Hunt, the architect, were so in demand. They traveled a lot. They were dealing with a lot of very important clients. They were dealing with the Chicago World Fair. And Olmsted would send back these detailed instructions to whoever, you know, was, you know, working at the house at the time on the ground, and would send instructions like, you know, don't make that line of trees too straight. It would never look that way in nature. I mean, his whole thing was he wanted to just have people feel as though they were submerged in this very natural setting that had always been there, and keep you shrouded in that before you came around the final bend for, as you said, that big reveal looking at the house. And it's a masterpiece. His approach to the house, I think, is as significant and as magical as the rest of the grounds that he laid out.
Well, you know, of course, you write about George and about Edith, about their travels, because they did some nice shopping trips.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. Oh, if only. Well, even as George was having the house built, he went over to Europe, and we do get to see, you know, a fair amount of Europe in the book, Paris especially. And George, you know, traveled over while he was working on the house to get inspiration from some of the chateaus in the Loire Valley in France. And he also went rug shopping. I think when he, that particular trip, he came back with, I think, about 300 rugs and some tapestries. So it was, you know, if only, dare to dream.
Exactly. And it was quite amazing that they almost took the Titanic.
They did. That's right. And they decided to take a different trip, really, a different ship at the last minute. And that, I think, just has that whole kind of, talk about a near miss. But of course, as Vanderbilt and as members of that sort of, you know, upper crust set in that period of time, of course, they would have wanted to, you know, book passage on the maiden voyage of this amazing ship that everyone was talking about. There was no other ship like it. But they were anxious. They were actually anxious to get home. Edith mentioned in a letter she wrote to one of their friends, and they changed their ticket and decided to take a different trip. And thank goodness for them, you know.
And on the Titanic was an Astor, John Jacob Astor.
John Jacob, that's right. Yes. So when you talk about things like the Titanic, or you talk about forestry, or you talk about like World War One. I mean, one of the things that I loved about doing this book was using Biltmore House and using Edith and George and Cornelia Vanderbilt really as this interesting lens through which to examine what was going on in America. During this time period, it became this really interesting lens through which to examine these things. And it was just so fascinating to look at these major world and American historical events, but look at them in an intimate way, to look at them as they affected this very unique family and this very unique home.
Well, I think this is a fantastic book. And it is called The Last Castle by Denise Kiernan, and it's available wherever books are sold. And Now, I know you're right up there today, right, in Ashley?
I'm in Asheville today. That's right. We launched the paperback here this evening at Malaprop's bookstore.
Okay.
And then I hit the road.
Okay. Well, you know, I want to thank you for being on Joy on Paper today, and I want to tell you that two things. One, I want to have you back because I really want to talk about The Girls of Atomic City, which is your...
Oh, love to.
Because it is, of course, was your big New York Times best-selling book, and I want to talk to you about it because I actually know, I knew one of the women who was involved in this whole adventure of the Atomic City Girls, and
wonderful.
So we have a lot to talk about. So I want to have you back, and I also want to tell you that my son is in Madison, Wisconsin, and he's going to come and see you, and because I told him
wonderful.
He has to come and see you. So I get all these books well in advance, so I don't have an autographed copy. So he's coming. And he's going to see you. You're going to be there on the 5th because he's at the university there doing his PhD. But he's going to come and see you. And so you have to sign a book for me. And
absolutely.
Okay. And while you're there, give him a kiss for me because I wish I could be there with you because I know because we were all up in Newport, and so we had seen the houses up in Newport together, and so I know that he will be fascinated with this book too, because I think we're going to put this on a list where maybe we'll have a family reunion there at the Biltmore.
Yes, because that's right. I know a lot of book clubs, once The Last Castle hit the New York Times bestseller list as well, when it came out. And a lot of book clubs came out to see me when I was on tour for the hardcover and said, we're doing this thing. Read the book. Take the trip. So a lot of book clubs are doing that now.
Okay. Well, I want to, again, thank you so much, Denise Kiernan, for being on Joy on Paper today, because it's been a joy to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Have a great trip.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Okay. Oh, she's nice. Oh, I love this book. Oh, my goodness. You just have to read it. Just to read the stories about their parties. You know, there's a lot in here. And it really does cover that era of the golden age and into the jazz age. There's a lot of the gossipy kind of stuff about particularly in the jazz age when some of the Vanderbilts went a little bit wild. And of course, we've seen and heard a lot about that. And as I said, the most famous Vanderbilt right now is, of course, Anderson Cooper, whose mother is Gloria Vanderbilt. So it's a fascinating story and beautiful, as I said, beautifully written. This is one of the wonderful things. If you have an idea for a nonfiction book, remember, nonfiction books are done differently from a fiction book. If you have a great idea for a fiction book and you have some writing chops behind you, you can put together a proposal and get an advance so that you can do your research. And I'm sure that she got quite a nice advance because she had a couple of years here of research. This is really in-depth work that she's done. So a book proposal for a nonfiction book is something that you should try. If you have a particular subject that you think would be of interest, why not try it? It's about 25 to 30 pages for a book proposal for a nonfiction book, and you send it in to agents, and they treat it very much like a regular submission for a query letter, but because they demand more details. And if they like the idea, they might know a publisher who would be interested in that subject. And there are just in our area here, I know there are lots of subjects that one might want to do a nonfiction book about. And so wherever you are, it doesn't matter if you're in Chicago, which, by the way, I hope they do not destroy that park there that Olmsted designed, because I think it would be a terrible shame because it is something special. But that's for another. I have actually an author who's going to be coming on and talking about that, because they are threatening to destroy a large part of that park, which would be sad. But meanwhile, do get this book. It's called The Last Castle. And it really is a castle, and the Biltmore Hotel. And you can stay there. I was just looking at the hotel part of the where you can stay up there in Asheville, North Carolina, and it's beautiful and doesn't cost that much. It's just a fancy hotel, but it's worth it, and you might want to go there. And meanwhile, again, I wanted to tell everyone, please, please do this Facebook thing for me, because I really need to have a bunch of likes, and I am just getting into Facebook now with all the problems. If you're looking for something you want to do on Facebook that's not controversial, all you have to do is go to Radio Joy on Paper and like me, and I would really, really appreciate it. And meanwhile, I also, you know, remember that if you have something coming, oh, you have Mother's Day coming up. Hey, listen, Mother's Day, it is a perfect time to buy your mother some nice pillows. Go to mypillow.com and use my promo code PATZI. What a wonderful gift. Really, my pillows are just terrific. I put my head down on a pillow and I'm asleep in 5 minutes. So it's really great. And I hope that you will think of that. And remember, my code is PATZI. It's easy. My name is Patsy with a Z. And also, what else is coming up? Oh, I have Jeffrey Deaver coming up next week. I have all sorts of wonderful things. And Steve Hopper is coming here on Thursday. And Steve Hopper is one of those marketing geniuses. He knows how to market himself. He knows how to market books, and he knows how to just market. And so I'm looking forward to having Steve here for the whole hour on Thursday, because I want to pick his brains on how you as an author can get out there and get noticed, because this is the most important thing with authors. We have so many places that you have to, things that you have to do, whether it's social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and of course, get out there and meet the public. So I'm very happy that Steve is going to be here to tell us about his adventures in writing and his success, and also his big success in promoting. Well, he certainly has promoted himself, that's for sure, and with ideas on how you can promote your book. So I'm looking forward to that. And meanwhile, what can I say? Oh, remember that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very lucky, to have them on the big screen or even in the small screen. And my guest the other last week was C. Hope Clark, and I think her books, her wonderful series, will be made into a television series. So she's done it because she's written a lot of books, and that's what you have to do too. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, who's always so nice to me, and he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. And I should have been a Marine, because I really like being saluted. Okay, bye-bye now.